Hello, heroes. Welcome to Modifier. I'm your host, Megan Dornbrock. All right, heroes. It's the week you've been waiting for. This is the episode where Modifier becomes a Sailor Moon fan podcast. But really, this week's show has been waiting in the wings since the end of February, if you can believe it, and covers a game I knew I wanted to share with you since Metatopia last year. The game is Beautiful Senshi Hearts, a magical girl spin on Monster Hearts, which is currently still in progress and being playtested. The co-writers and guests today are Anne, Josh, and James, with surprise guest Lisa. We had a super fun time talking about the game and the genre, but this was also nearly 4 months ago and we were still figuring out Zencastr at that point. Please forgive us, and I hope you enjoy this as much as I did. Let's get to the show. Cool, so we are a full house today.
Woo.
Why don't we start with introductions? We'll just go in order of arrival here, so let's start with Anne.
Hi, I'm Anne, primarily a college student, but I am one of the co-writers of Beautiful Senshi Hearts, which is what we're talking about today.
Yeah. All right. James.
Yes. I am a software developer by day, game developer by night, another co-author. So all the good parts you can credit to Anne and Josh, all the bad parts I'll take all no credit for. But
yeah, but you're also the only one who actually ran it.
That's true, yeah.
So far.
That means I am literally the best GM you can ever get right now for Beautiful Senshi Hearts.
Yeah, you ran it for me, so okay. It was great.
Oh, thank you. And that's my introduction.
Okay, and then we've got Josh.
Hi, I'm Joshua Kronigold. I'm also a code developer at Day, and a game designer and a whole bunch of other things by night. Or on the weekends. If you hate the idea of Beautiful Senshi Hearts, it's my idea. if you like it, it's still my idea. And I'm also a co-developer on the game.
Awesome. And you've got someone there with you, Josh, yes?
I do. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
And Lisa's a playtester, right? She's played this game.
Once.
Oh, once. Cool. Me too.
I'm Lisa Paddle. I edit stuff, mostly role-playing game products, supplements, and so on.
So what kind of things have you edited?
The Familiar Magazine, if anyone remembers that.
Recently, dear.
Oh, you mean Down to Green?
Yes, that.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
They just released the Quick Start Guide for everybody.
Nice.
Like, literally, after I sent Shane the "This is as good as I can make it," he released it.
Oh, that's great.
It's scary because everybody's going to be looking at it.
That's exciting, though.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so we are definitely talking a lot about Beautiful Senshi Hearts today. So all three of you are billing yourselves as co-writers. So how did this kind of happen? How'd you get started?
James ran a fiasco game in Manitoba, wasn't it?
Yes, James?
Yep. It was a Magic Girl playset.
Ooh.
So imagine, if you haven't played Fiasco, the Coens brothers doing live-action Sailor Moon.
I like it.
Yes.
It was. Oh, and we played through it. It was a lot of fun.
I remember if that was the game with the buoyancy powers and the one player character was having an evil lair.
Yes. And
oh,
the
nice.
Noodles.
And the noodles. Oh, God, the noodles.
And we were all pulling in different directions, but it worked. However, it didn't feel to me the way characters typically go wrong in a magical girl game. Because usually in a magical girl game, they're all pulling in the same direction until somebody decides enough is enough and starts pulling and pulls away from the group and goes off on their own. Mm-hmm. Which felt much more the way Monster Hearts works, where the characters, yes, they may have their differences, but they're doing sort of things, and then at some point, somebody goes dark as self. And then things go really dark.
And we've been immersing ourselves in Sailor Moon on account of he got cast as Sailor Moon in the Sailor Moon lore.
Nice.
Oh, good. That's too good.
I'm Sailor Mars.
Oh, wonderful. So you guys are always fighting then?
We were, actually.
We were, actually.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. True to form.
But he had to get a sewing machine, see, because it wasn't the original Sailor Moon outfit. It was the one with the three layers from, what was it, Super S?
Ooh.
Yes, which I hadn't seen at the time. I've now seen all of Sailor Moon. It's a thing that happens.
Good, good. You should.
And so in a total reversal of gender roles, I'm going, just put on a white blouse and a skirt and it'll be fine. He's like, no, we gotta do this right.
Oh, that's wonderful. You do have to do it right. It's... How...
It was worth it.
I have so many questions now about this LARP. So anyway, Senshi Hearts started as, well, inspired by this fiasco game, and now you've taken it to Monster Hearts. Did Monster Hearts, did that system jump out at you kind of immediately as, yes, this is the way to do it? Or did you play a little more with Fiasco or any other systems?
So for me, Monster Hearts jumped out as the system to do it in. Because Monster Hearts had, there's a bunch of things going on in Monster Hearts, even apart from similarities to other Apocalypse games. You have Darkest Self as sort of this mechanic or concept of that at some point characters will flip from being on your side or sort of being generally on the same character side to becoming villains or becoming, if not villains, obstacles. But you also have these relationship mechanics where, yes, you have adventures and stuff going on that's supernatural, but you also have relationships you're forming. And those are very critical to most Magical Girl games. And that actually presented some problems in the playtest we can get to later if you want to talk about that.
Oh, we will, yes. It's a very good system. I mean, there's jokes that everybody has an Apocalypse World hack or a Monster Heart hack, but for a reason, it really lends itself to exploring all kinds of stories.
Yes.
Oh, very true.
And it's, in many ways, I mean, there's a specific agenda to the Apocalypse Engine in terms of the way it's put together, the idea that nobody should know where the game is going, the idea that is explicitly what the King of Feral concept is for, but also it's just a way of putting things together in a way that is easy to understand and easy to run. And having that sort of package where you've got the playbook technology, you've got advancements in play, and a bunch of other things, you know, make it feel like a cohesive whole, even though, many of those pieces of gaming tech can be used individually. And we're seeing actually not just a lot of Apocalypse World hacks, but a lot of games, whether or not they're building themselves that way or inspired by Apocalypse World, yep. Mm-hmm. They're not actually hack.
And this, you've mentioned a couple times now, it heavily influenced by Sailor Moon, is your idea that these stories are kind of more in the Sailor Moon end of the Mahou Shoujo spectrum? I know a lot of people lean towards darker storytelling. We're going to tell a Madoka kind of story where everyone's dark, or are you sort of leaving that up to however people want to use this?
Well, actually, one thing that I'm working on is to clarify that for each individual group. I think it's important for this kind of game to lend itself. There are reoccurring themes. For example, if you look at Sailor Mars, or if you were to go to Fairy Tale Natsu, or if you go to Perella Pudding Magica, I think it's called. I'm very
bad Medica
with
Magica.
That name.
Yeah.
If you look at Kyoko, you notice that there's a reoccurring theme with all of these characters. They are driven by emotion. And at the same time, they all have ridiculously sad backstories. Like with Sailor Mars, where are her parents?
Oh, yeah, it's bad.
Yeah. So you have reoccurring themes in all of these characters, regardless of the darkness. Mm-hmm. One thing that I am particularly trying to clarify within the system, which will hopefully lend itself a bit more given time because we are still in alpha, is this world-creating minor system that gives enough to clarify for each individual group. Do we want to play a dark game? Do we want to play a lighthearted game? And have that relate back to each individual character in order to get a more cohesive story.
Nice. I love that choice is going to be there and be built in for people who maybe even from game to game have a slightly different opinion on how they want to approach it.
And I think you're right, by the way, that even within a series, you know, if you look at let's go back to Sailor Moon. Sailor Moon,
yes,
mostly very bright and very heroic. It does get dark at times.
People die.
Yeah.
A bunch.
End of season one. Oh, man.
You have to be admit, Sailor Moon has quite the body count.
That is also true. End of season anything.
Yeah, that's true.
Lighthearted until your heart is breaking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And splattered in the stardust by a moon crescent beam attack.
But one of the challenges with something like Sailor Moon, as opposed to Madoka, which is very tight, is you've got, in the original series, this slow, repetitive cycle that does progress, and you do get payoff in one of the movies where all of the girls are saying, we were alone and miserable until Sailor Moon came to us, and that's the first time you realize that's absolutely true. And the reason you realize that is the slow, repetitive build-up, but if I'm playing week after week, I mean, not want that much reputation.
Right. And you don't necessarily want the pace of Crystal, where they put that front and center, but in some ways it's a little less satisfying. But nevertheless, you still want, in a game, you're probably not going to have 2 years to play to work everything out with Monster of the Week stuff, but you still want to have a lot of that feel to it where you're putting things on the table and then building them up before you really patch them in.
Also, Apocalypse World Engine, whatever system it is not a slow game.
True.
Things move, things change pretty quickly.
Yes.
I'm sorry, James, I think we talked over you a little.
Well, I was saying, yeah, it's a whole different medium to get the... Yeah, accordingly. I'm actually going to be starting a Monster Hearts campaign here in New York soon, thinking about how I'm going to treat that, what I can take away from playing that game. I actually have not played Monster Hearts that much. It's weird to think of how I actually have more experience with tabletop games than I do with Sailor Moon. It's kind of like taking it from two different angles that way.
Yeah. Have you played like other role-playing games that are sort of Sailor Moon-ish?
Not too much. More just other role-playing games. Probably here and there, especially over at the Double Exposure conventions. They have such a variety over there.
Yeah, I think we all bring a very different experience to the table. I know I have played... I played Big Eyes Small Mouth back in the day, and it was very frustrating.
Oh, yeah.
I remember as well, yeah.
Oh, because it was a, you know, sort of, it was all focused on all the powers the characters have, but the game doesn't play anything like, you know, even their Sailor Moon doesn't play anything like Sailor Moon. And I also have a lot of Apocalypse World around Apocalypse World. I've never played Apocalypse, but I have a lot of Monster Hearts games sort of been playing my way through the playbooks
I've
over
played
time.
It twice.
You've played Monster Hearts more than I have, I think.
Yeah, barely. You're catching up.
Uh-huh.
That's interesting. I think I've played Monster Hearts a few times now and still have yet to play Apocalypse World, but I've played so many games sort of based on it that I feel like I know what's going on.
Well, the thing is, Apocalypse World did it first and did it very well and set the map, but Monster Hearts is the thing that just clicks with a lot of us.
And as I recall, yeah. Anne, I think you've played a lot of Dungeon World, which I've only played like once, and I think Lisa's not played at all.
Once.
I played zero times.
Yeah, I am relatively familiar with Dungeon World. I find it's a game that I have difficulty running, but I have a pretty well verse of the system itself.
Yeah, it's a funny thing comparing looking at Dungeon World, because it's so much crunchier than a lot of other Apocalypse World systems. Maybe more numbers and math and more towards that simulationist end than the storytelling end. I'm not sure where we're going to do with that. I can see us doing more, maybe relationship modeling, crunchier relationship modeling with Beautiful Sachi Hearts, or not. Something we're still trying to feel out. Yeah, might even go in terms of making the story progression a little bit crunchier. The whole get a season progression like you would on TV.
Mm.
That's one thing I find a little both interesting and frustrating regarding Dungeon World. Dungeon World, more than any other Apocalypse game I know, is designed for longer-term play. Now, that said, what I've heard from people who've sort of played it to the end is that, as you might expect, when you get to the point where characters all have, like, plus threes and everything, the game drags a little more, because they're not getting failures as much. You have to spend a whole bunch of time playing with success modifiers, and that can make the game feel a lot less like an Apocalypse World game.
And one other thing that Dungeon World does that's particularly interesting is those failures actually give you experience. So by making mistakes, let's say I was playing this one character where I got one successful roll in the entire 3 to 4 hour session, and that one time I finally got a successful roll, the bard decided, well, maybe this creature that is attacking us might be sentient, so I am going to detriment your roll and make it so you yet again miss. And while I wasn't able to do much in that session, I was level 2 by the end of it.
Nice.
Which is a pretty interesting progression. Because of what I was unable to do in that session, I was able to do more in the next. So that's one of the things that is saddening about later game of Dungeon World, is you don't have that benefit as much from failure. It just becomes uninteresting, and when it does happen, because it is so rare, the experience doesn't really mean as much, because one experience means nothing compared to three, which will actually add up to something very quickly.
Yeah, it's actually something I've noticed in Sailor Moon and other Magic Girl series, is that while they technically power up, or at least the exposition says they power up, the actual battles usually don't get any bigger or too very much flashier. Mm-hmm. It feels like it's very much the same power level, just mixed up a bit. Something you might consider doing Beautiful Sachi Hearts is more swapping out necessarily than necessarily powering up, keeping things interesting that way.
We've talked about a season reset mechanic.
Yeah.
And I'm very mixed on the idea. I think people don't like the idea. I'm where you basically have a, you know, when you hit the end of a quote unquote season, your character keeps some a bunch of the things that they've gained. They keep whatever chrome changes they've changed, but they've mechanically reset almost to the beginning. And on the one hand, this feels very much like Sailor Moon.
Yeah.
In the later seasons of Sailor Moon, you know, yes, they're dealing with bigger threats. They're dealing with people, you know, every season, even though the battles sort of take place in the same more or less space, the scale is bigger. You know, they deal with, you know, in the first one, they're dealing with planetary threats. The second one, they're dealing with time threats. And then they're dealing with interplanetary threats. And they're dealing with interstellar threats. The scale is definitely getting bigger over time. But you have people, you know, having the same amount of, something, this hit us. And no, our attacks are doing nothing against it. We're going to spend a whole bunch of time dodging.
Do you think it's a matter of how you frame that refresh or that restart in that are people maybe reacting negatively to thinking, oh no, I'm at level one because, I mean, you are, but you're not really.
Well, I guess it's still theoretical at this point since we don't have the long-term campaign test data yet. So then we're simply going to have to try out and see what works.
At the same time, it also is a very difficult role because or path that we're taking if we were to put in the season reset mechanic, because that may not be the story that people want to deal with. And as a result, if we have a season reset, chances are we also have to consider some sort of what if people don't want that.
Yeah.
Yes. So probably less now you have to reset so much as if you want to reset, then we recommend doing this.
If you want to do another season and make it feel like a really another season where you're going through the full arc, then, you know, you need to set yourself at a point where a growth arc makes sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So a question for you guys. I don't know what order these episodes are going to fall in, so listeners will either get to look forward to this or will have already heard this. I'm talking to someone else who one of their projects is a magical girl game, and there's been some struggle in promoting it, especially to get playtesters at conventions and things like that. What kind of reaction do you think you've received or have you noticed you've received by having such a blatantly obvious magical girl game on the table here for people to come play? What is the response like to that?
That's definitely been good for me so far. I've had no problem finding players.
Yeah. In general, I've seen very positive responses. Yeah, we do have very much the people come to a table and half of them want to play Sailor Moon and half of them want to, you know, dive into the darkness with with Madoka. And that itself is a different kind of problem. And one of the things I've considered is billing playtesting sessions with particular themes. One, to front load things and so that people don't have to negotiate the theme as much. So you have some things tied down, but also you don't have a table where, you know, half of the people want to spend half the time making tea parties and the other half of the table want to be slitting their wrists.
That being said, probably one of the benefits that we've seen is, at least among the gaming communities that we've been primarily playtesting with, magical girl games seem to be the most recent fad. So there has been a lot of interest, at least within the small circuits.
Interesting.
It's all the more reason to hurry up and get that draft finished and get that Kickstarter right there.
Yeah.
One thing I've noticed, I don't know if you guys have changed it, is that you offer a bunch of suggestions for a direction in which to take any given archetype. But certain archetypes, you said, a player always goes that way.
Yes, that's been an issue. Yeah. That is something we need to look at.
Cool. So actually, yeah, why don't you tell me about these archetypes, the skins for beautiful Senshi hearts?
Okay, so currently we are dealing with, I believe it's a total of 7 different archetypes. We may add more at some later point or remove some, but it has seemed like this primarily covers the majority of the categories. Oh, the 7th one is not actually in the process of being written yet. So we currently have 6. Oh, I lie. It was 7. I can't read.
That's okay.
So we're going to start off probably with the most generic, the head of whatever your group is.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the Nexus. The whole point of the Nexus is that they are emotionally connected to other people. When it comes to actual fighting ability, they do not really have a lot of power or potency, but their power comes from those around them. So pretty much your Sailor Moon or your Madoka, like particularly with Madoka, she never actually fights, at least the storyline that we see.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So the Nexus is the pink one.
Yes. Although you do get some color alterations other than pink. You don't have to be pink. You can be white. You can be orange. You can be blue.
Scandal.
I know.
Like pink and light red, I think were two options.
Yeah, light red.
Yeah. So you don't actually have to be pink. And again, because Fairy Tail maps so beautifully well onto what we've been designing, you also have Lucy, if that means anything.
Oh, okay.
Like, I think you can see it's that kind of personality type that you're going through. Again, not particularly strong in herself, but her ability to collect friends.
Right.
Well, and that's actually something that we're considering is, I mean, Lucy from Fairy Tail is the kind of character who brings people together, who sort of reaches out to people and is emotionally vulnerable, but emotionally attractive in a very direct fashion. But she's also sort of a pet type character. And these are frequently connected. They're not always connected. We've discussed whether we want, because a pet type character, yes, frequently they are very much someone who reaches out to other characters, but also they're partially defined by their relationship to the whatever beings or people they work with. That they are all about, rather than directly attacking a problem, getting a friend to help them, whether that friend is some kind of magical friend or is just someone in the environment. And so at the moment, those are all the nexus. And I'm not sure that that'll remain, but it's certainly, there's enough connection between those types, even if, say, Buffy the Vampire Slayer does not feel very much like Lucy, that at the moment, they're all the same archetype.
Yeah, because like Spiff, he is basically Nexus plus moves from a different archetype, or vice versa.
Cool.
Then from there, we have the genius, or the blue one.
Yep.
As I think you can tell from that generic type of situation, very smart to the point where it might actually be to the detriment, because they seek knowledge. And a lot of their design seems to be a slightly more supporty type. Well, it is not necessarily, just there is that reoccurring theme that the smart one has some sort of support-like role in the group.
Very cool.
The next one is the Inferno, and this is the one we were talking about having always being played the same way.
Oh, I'm curious to hear how they get played, because I believe I was the Inferno in my test.
Yeah.
My play. So.
The Inferno is the person with very, very strong feelings, aka the red one.
Yes.
And again, you don't have to actually wear red. We probably need to play around with the colors a bit more to make it a bit more diversified. But one of the things that makes this playbook slightly different, is one of our, there's a couple of playbooks where you don't have a set start. You have a choice between two. So one is, as seen in Sailor Moon, there's some connection to the supernatural. The other one is what we ended up calling for now Fire in the Belly, is you just have this major amount of passion and energy behind you that drives you forward.
I think I picked that.
Yeah. More specifically, also in Origin, the reoccurring theme is people want to be somehow related to a dragon.
Yes. Okay. There are backgrounds listed for these characters. And I remember I looked at several of the archetypes because the folks at our table were kind of changing their minds and deciding, oh no, I would really rather be this. So I was two or three different things before the Inferno landed in front of me. Mm-hmm. And one of the backgrounds for the Inferno is dragon, and you can't put that choice in front of a person and not have them take it.
There's one exception to that, and that was a Nobilis game.
But yes, so far this game has been playtested, I believe, at least four times.
It's been more than that.
Yes, and every time I know of, the person who picked the Inferno has picked the dragon background.
Yeah. Also, someone always picks the Inferno.
Oh yeah, I think our group was full and the Inferno was what was left over. So I was like, okay, I'll try this. This isn't usually the kind of character I go for, but it was great. Of course I'm going to be a dragon. Like,
And of course the dragon background is inspired by Natsu in Fairy Tail.
At the same time, it does make a lot of sense because, again, if you have the reoccurring supernatural theme, instead of speaking necessarily to ghosts, you could be talking to a dragon. Like, it totally works in line.
Yeah.
But it does mean that when you put that option on the table, you want to make sure there are other similar, that there are other options that are in the same scale. Otherwise, everyone's going to be the dragon.
Except even we've tried very hard to make other things of similar skill, someone is always the dragon.
Yeah.
We have tried very hard to...
And that may be okay. I mean, it may be okay that the first time you play this game and you play an Inferno, you're always going to be a dragon. And the second time you go, maybe today I don't want to be a dragon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. That's for the second time around. Because maybe I won't be the next time, and that's okay.
Yeah.
the other Nexus, not the Nexus, the other archetype ends up usually being a knight protecting said dragon.
Yeah, that happened in our game. It's so good.
Three times now. Three or four
Which
times.
Which one?
Really? Oh,
wow. Yeah.
The mountain is always a knight. So yeah, that's what I think we're on. I'm trying to keep an order of how they appear in Sailor Moon just to make them easier for most people to approach.
Well, I guess we'll add a thought on that. It's like, well, if it's such a common thing, we clearly hit a, like, not a nerve there, but just hit a gold mine there and just, I say, roll with it.
Yeah, there's a really compelling story there, yeah. I feel like. Especially if so many other games have picked up on that one. I don't know what you would do with it, but it's so fun to play.
So we haven't talked that much about the mountain, and we'll get to it in a moment.
Yeah.
I just want to point out there, so one of my formative, more or less, anime experiences was watching this OAV Dragon Half, which I'm told was a longer manga, but cut to just like 2 half-hour or 1 hour sequences for the American market because it was only popular in America. They hated it in Japan or something like that. And where the main character is this half dragon woman who falls for this great superstar who's a dragon slayer. Dick Saucer, who's a dragon slayer, and so the moment he sees her, he goes, "Dragon, I have to kill it."
And she's just like, "I'm so in love with you. You are the prettiest thing I have ever seen."
I love how she's so much more powerful than him, too.
So every time I see this dragon knight pairing, that's what I flash to, because I sort of have to.
Oh, wow, I can't get out of my head now.
Yeah, I want to play this game.
That's the next 7 times it happens. I'm going to have to remember this.
So is the mountain next?
Yep. Okay, so the rough outline of the mountain is just short of a social justice warrior. That is, in fact, one of the characters that you can play as a social justice warrior. And they have very strong emotions on a particular subject. Unlike the Inferno, who is driven by passion and emotion, and they just feel strongly about things in general, the mountain has very strong feelings on one thing in particular. For example, protecting my friends. So protection. Or should it be justice, like this capital J justice that overlooks everything, and they become a very stubborn personality because of it.
It's basically they're principled, the capital P, principled.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see how the protecting my friends, somebody taking that leads very easily into the knights that protect the dragon instead of fighting the dragon, yep. But I think...
Uranus and Neptune.
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah. Mm.
There's also the question of what do you mean by protect my friends? It might go to the point where it might be detrimental to them because this person insulted my friend. I have to protect them for honor's sake.
Yeah, protect them from themselves.
Or for that matter, my friend wants to go into danger. No, you have to stay here. You're in danger.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
Like, what happens when that character is demonstrably wrong about something? Because they're not inclined to change their positions.
And in that case, the knight is the reoccurring theme. So from here, we kind of transition away from the more center characters to less common themes.
Mm-hmm.
Starting off with the mysterious one, which is the person who shows up out of nowhere, the black one, does really cool things, and then disappears.
Oh.
And they're exactly the mysterious one because you're not exactly sure who they are. With the majority of the other characters, if not all of them, you have a very strong understanding of who the person is, at least within the group, and who they are outside. But with the mysterious one, there's sort of this mix between, I can't tell if they're friend or foe because there's too many secrets.
Oh, that seems really interesting, especially there's a lot to do in Monster Hearts and in this game, tying your characters to each other. Does that become difficult with the mysterious one?
It's an interesting question. In theory, it shouldn't be, because the mysterious one does still cart through connections with people. They have people that they're paying attention to, but the mysterious one is by nature going to be a less formed character than the other. If you start out playing the mysterious one, you may not know or may not have decided exactly what your character's background is. You're leaving that a mystery, possibly even to yourself. And so, yes, you'll have connections to people. You're going to have reasons to interact with people and to keep coming back, because otherwise, why are you playing this game? But by the same token, you're leaving some stuff unwritten and undone to be developed and play, which is, I think, a character type that can be very attractive to some people. The intent is eventually your mysterious one will probably become a little less mysterious. And so at some point, they will transition to another archetype. And in fact, the mysterious one has a move where they transition to another archetype to keep a lot of the stuff that they've developed as a mysterious one. But now they're known. Now they've taken something. They're no longer about showing up from nowhere and then disappearing back to nowhere.
Basically, they become the revealed one.
coming on to playbook number 6, we have the Wise One, who is, to put it simply, you are either a actually talking animal or you are Giles.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Okay.
So either you are an animal that, because of the weirdness of being a talking animal, you are somehow supernatural in that case and weird within yourself, as in seen in the case of Luna and Artemis, or you have a lot of really cool stuff that gives you additional wisdom that normally you wouldn't have because of all sorts of training that you've had in your past. And as seen, this is the other playbook where you have a pretty, not super dramatic, but a choice on who you want to be.
Yeah, one thing I like about that character, that archetype, is that I think we have a move in the last draft where you have a human form instead of the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
It just assumes you're going to be small and need everyone's help and not totally not a fighter and presumably not human by default.
Oh, so they can become human, but it's a much rarer occurrence, or... Do they not become human at all now?
It's just a move you choose.
Okay.
Yeah. So, in fact, if you look at... I mean, so, obviously, one has to go back to Sailor Moon for this, you know, with Luna. In the original Sailor Moon, the original anime Sailor Moon, Luna is a cat and stays a cat, except for one movie. But in both the manga and Crystal, she does eventually develop the ability to turn human. You know, it's not something she uses often, but it's something that shows up, you know, becomes part of her power set. And similarly in Nanaha, you have a character who, yes, they're a sage, but they flip back and forth between something that's a little like a ferret and someone human. Even if they sort of they still have that sort of helper background authority. That actually brings us to, so we mentioned, you know, it seems pretty obvious, but both the Wise One and the Blue One are very much brains archetypes.
Yeah.
So one of the things that differentiates them is the Blue One is all about being a tactician and discovering things and being good at figuring things out. The Wise One, the thing that really clinches them as a unique archetype is that they're all about being the person who already knows the background you're exploring. They are already tied in some more essential way to the past, to the mystery. You know, Giles is tied to the council. Kyubey is the alien. I'm not going to spoil, you know, but Kyubey is, is the weird stuff that is going on and knows much more than anybody else about what's going on. And so that connection to the truth puts the Wise One in a very different place than the other archetypes, because they can even take a move that allows them to make pronunciations about what's going on, what's true in the world, and, you know, sort of take some of that authority from the GM or work with the GM to share that authority, because their character isn't discovering what's weird about the world. They already know.
Granted, at the same time, as with any playbook, their memory may not be as good as they thought. So what they thought to be true is left, right, of center. And one of the other things, referring back to how this game can turn dark, is, as you can obviously tell, the Wise One is thoroughly trusted by their companions. However, I'm referring to a move referred to as Sophic Agenda. You have agenda which may or may not match the agenda of the magical girls you advise. So instantly you have this, you should be trusted. But at the same time, if you so choose, you can manipulatively have them walk in a direction and do something that they're not intending to.
Remember, this is a move you can take after character creation.
You know, this move can both covers, you know, you're a teacher, you're trying to guide people toward the right way, but it could mean your agenda very much does not match their best interests, and you're trying to guide them what you think is the right way.
Which is the right way for you and not for anyone else.
For the greater good.
Yeah. Going on to the final playbook, which is the Visionary, and this is probably by far the strangest playbook that we have. It is the least incomplete, simply because it is such a strange concept.
Mm-hmm.
You are dealing with this character who somehow relates really deeply into what's going on, but not in a way that they can control. So, as was seen in Fairy Tail, you have Yuvia, who is possibly this redeemed villain. And then you have one who has to work alongside the group, but has goals that are in a direct opposition, not necessarily in a bad way, but puts them in this very tense situation as seen with Pluto.
Oh, okay.
And then you have the final one is someone who is just so in a strange position that they're not able to really control themselves, as seen in the case of River Tam in Firefly, where she is so intricately related to what's going on, but at the same time, she's a victim because of that.
Right, there's no choice there.
Yes, and it's just because, as I think you can see, there's a reoccurring theme in all of these that there's something very off-putting about them. They have this control, but at the same time have no control. They're all combined into one playbook, but the wording needs to be very specific, which we haven't gotten yet.
Yeah, that seems like it'll be one of the trickier ones to pin down.
It is, mm-hmm. But it's a very distinct archetype in a lot of ways. You've got this, this character who is very dark. They're playing a different game than everybody else.
Raven from the Teen Titans, for example.
Oh, that's a good one, yeah.
And of course, I think the archetype makers for this were, I'm blanking. There's a character from Puella Magica Magica.
Homura Akemi.
Yes.
The one with the darkness and the visions, right.
Yes. And the one with the darkness and the visions was, so we've had gone through several names for these archetypes. One of them we were going through the one with, and eventually we discarded that as the central names for each archetype because it's very unwieldy and it makes it very hard to talk about the archetype. We've kept them as subtitles because they're fun, but you know, they don't really work as central names. So this one, yeah, this is one of the dark visions. So I think Sailor Pluto, you can make arguments back and forth. Sailor, which is the sailor who's...
Saturn.
Sailor Saturn is definitely this archetype.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Because, you know, she spends a whole bunch of time being the, well, I'm interacting with people. I'm very much acting like a PC. But when my powers come out, it feels really scary and dark, and I don't really know what's going on, and nobody else does either.
Yeah.
But you guys also had some archetypes on the to-be-considered pile. The mascot, the lovers.
The mascot is to turn into the wise one. Probably. Maybe.
Yeah.
She views
that. Okay.
Then there's the wannabe, which is
the wannabe.
We shall not be named.
Mm-hmm.
Sailor Chibi Moon.
Oh, we're not on board with Chibi Moon.
It's a situation of a lot of people have this very distinct distaste for her because she wants to be something that she's not.
Mm-hmm.
And at least from one of the things I've seen is that she's one of the most disliked anime characters. Granted, you also have people who adore her because of it.
The thing is, if you go through the whole arc, just like Sailor Moon, she's very much a growth character.
Yeah, she becomes
what she wants to be.
Yes.
Yeah.
But for the longest time, she's like, why don't you love me? Why don't you like me? I'm really cool and awesome. Can you stop trying to do things that will obviously get you killed?
Actually, it's sort of a conflict between why don't you love me and I hate you, go away.
Now, at the same token, she is in one of the best examples in both versions of the show, actually, of the character who, due to their own issues, where it's not just external, they go dark and they become an enemy for a while before they're redeemed. In order to redeem them, you can't just beat them up. You have to also address their issue.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And I think that character, too, would kind of help drive the plot in a lot of ways. It could be really interesting. But so that's a to be considered.
And I think you also had the lovers on the to be considered pile.
We were considering it. We'll see.
It's a tricky one.
It's a tricky one. And frankly, Uranus and Neptune start out as mysterious ones.
They do.
Yeah.
And eventually they turn into other archetypes as they become more known. But clearly they're very early. They're just mysterious ones. You know, they're mysterious ones with an agenda. You have the weirdness that early on, you're not really getting a sense of them as separate characters. I mean, you are in their mundane lives, but you're not, you know, when they show up, they just fight together and they act together. But eventually they do have enough separation that you can really see them as two separate characters. The question of whether there's an archetype that represents someone who's really playing two characters that sort of always go together is an interesting one. I don't know. I'm not sure there's enough play there.
Something to consider for later archetypes, yeah.
It'd be more like you'd have a move that anyone could take with anyone else to be lovers or something. Because you've got it between Usagi and Mamoru, you've got it between Uranus and Neptune.
But isn't that just a relationship?
It's different than the other relationships.
Because it's true love.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's still an open question whether it's going to be mechanically supported or not. Whether it's something that the larger relationship mechanics would just model in a particular way.
So do we want to talk about relationship modeling? Because I think we've gone through, we're not done with that yet.
Yeah.
We've gone through a bunch of interesting places there.
I would be curious to hear how that has been going. Because I know there's been lots of back and forth, and there was a lot of feedback given at my game on how some of those things worked. So for Monster Hearts, people have strings with each other, and that sort of cements these relationships and really forces you to interact in interesting ways. But Beautiful Senshi Hearts, at least when I played it, worked a little bit differently. So how would you explain that, how it works now and sort of how that process has been going?
Let's see, we had both notes, which are very close to strings, and we also had bonds, which almost more like rope than a string, and that was a much stronger connection and did not just go away because of everyone just spent the same way that notes were. We played around with significant notes, ones with, well, notes attached. We played around with notes turning automatically into bonds, various other things. It's been interesting so far, having a kind of, I guess, semi-permanent connection between different characters. So it's still very much filling that space out. Because one thing we are worried about, we don't want to necessarily foist relationships on between characters just because they have a certain number gets to 5 instead of 6. At the same time, that does seem interesting the way that makes stuff happen. So I guess it seems to be one of the more central challenges with Beautiful Senshi Hearts is modeling that relationships in the way that both evokes Mahou Shoujo Magic Girl with while still being mechanically viable.
So what would an example of a bond versus a note be?
Yeah, right now notes are pretty indistinguishable from strings because we tried tracking mm-hmm. the significance of a note, like where it came from or what particular connection was, but found that just too much bookkeeping. We had just like a table full of post-it notes.
So notes were something that happened. So it was a sort of a momentary, this is something that happened. Bonds were how you thought of someone. Bonds represented sort of an overall feeling about somebody that had some lasting effect. Whereas a note was, there was a specific thing that happened. One of the ways in which this was problematic, it's a cool idea and sort of response to one of the issues I've had with Monster Hearts in play, which is that people will, when you use a note on someone to try to get them to do something, they will generally ignore the context in which you got the note, unless you remind them. So even though, I got this because you've been watching me, if you're trying to get them to use the note to get them to, say, watch you, the player may go, nah, I don't really want to, sort of just ignoring the entire context that the characters have a relationship in, because in Monster Hearts, characters don't have relationships. Characters have leverage. And in a Magical Girl world, most of the time, there can be some leverage. There certainly will be negative feelings one side or the other, but a lot of the time it's about building relationships. And that's more than just leverage. It's about connection.
And one of the interesting alterations we've been playing with is that because of it's a relationship between two characters and not social leverage, you can get these bonds off of NPCs, and more specifically, villains. Because as you can see in particular Magical Girl games, as seen in like Yuvia, who in Fairy Tail was originally a villain and becomes one of the clan, and in the first season of Sailor Moon, where one of the villains, who is somehow a sentient rock of some sort, becomes completely infatuated with an NPC, and through that actually ends up teaming up with the Magical Girls before meeting his doom because of it. It's one of those, because everything is centered around relationships and about character development, the villains can also do that. And their interactions with the PCs, particularly, probably most potently, the Nexus, you can end up befriending them.
And in fact, in the second season of Sailor Moon, not in, I know, in the manga or in Crystal, but the characters, the original villains, the Dark Moon Sisters were all turned onto the good side and redeemed rather than killed.
We don't want to fight.
And again, they all had developed their issues about what, of the way they saw the world and the way they were redeemed. It wasn't just, someone was nice to them. It's they had the error of their ways showed to them. They had, their issues confronted, in a very direct way. Rather than, by addressing these issues, rather than sort of just mechanizing them, it feels a lot more real.
Do the bonds change over the course of the game, or is there room for that?
There is in the bond system. No, we're still considering another system, which I think James is going to talk about.
What do we have right now? Well, we've played with things like having a certain number of bonds, a certain number of notes on someone turn into a bond automatically. One example move we've considered for the Nexus is that she needs less notes to get a bond on someone.
Oh, for sure.
And at the same time, other characters might actually need more notes but they're like the city here in the mountain need more notes to get a bond on someone. But at the same time, that bond is also more resilient. So, like, for example, she's not going to break up with her boyfriend as quickly as the Nexus might, or it's not nearly as quickly as someone like the Inferno might, who do so regularly.
Yeah.
We've also talked about, so the issue with notes is that it feel, again, the note, you know, the notes feel like leverage. And there's an interesting question about how much leverage we want, really want the characters to have on each other, how much we want that to be part of the game. One of the things we've experimented with, but we certainly haven't made any firm decisions, is replacing that entire mechanic with a concern mechanic, where rather than it being, you know, I have a relationship with so-and-so, and I also have some leverage on them. Instead, it's, I care about so-and-so, and, you know, I'm, let's say, Sailor Moon, just because it's an easy example. I, as Sailor Mars, think that Sailor Moon isn't studying enough. And this is a constant concern. It's something I'm worried about, that she's going to fail all her classes and ruin her life. And so I am going to be spending time saying, are you studying? Do you want to go study with me? You know, how are your grades? And that's going to be something that's sort of the, you know, an undercurrent of the play in our relationship. And so rather than simply saying we have a relationship there, it's, this is what our relationship is, and this is what my direction is generally going to be pushing towards.
Yeah, it has the advantage of being very one-sided. So it's much more in the owner of the concern's control and does not foist any sort of expectations on the other character. It helps guide actions and stories because it tells the player you're expecting yourself to do X, you're worried about Y happening, very certain things in a way that a simple bond wouldn't. And it was much easier to set up, well, much more lightweight to set up than a bond. And to say, I have these, like from character creation, for example, you can easily say, I have these two different concerns and see them whether or not they play out. Because there is room both to see concerns be sort of verified over time or inverted entirely in some models we have for that concern mechanic.
If you look at Keys in Shadow of Yesterday,
yeah,
then those, you know, you've got a mechanic that whenever you do something that fits a sort of thing, then you mark experience. It's Shadow of Yesterday predates Apocalypse Edge. But there was also a variant of Keys. At least, what system was that? Was that Princess Kingdom? Or was that... No, it was the other one. No, it was the solar system hack about, that was YA.
That was the one Judd Conman was working on, First Quest. He never
First Quest.
Finished
Wait, unfortunately, he never finished. But one of the lovely mechanics there is you had a key that whenever you do something fitting your key, you'd mark experience. If somebody else did something that validated your key, you'd also mark experience. They would mark experience. And so I, at one point, ran a hack of that, Etherixy, not the other Etherixy that's actually come out as a published game.
No, totally.
Where you had a character who was a girl who had disguised herself as a boy. And so whenever she did something to emphasize the, I am in fact actually an identified girl, but I'm dressed as a boy, she would mark experience. When somebody else...
He really does make a good girl in disguise.
Yeah, exactly. Commented on her maleness and basically addressed that and bumped up against it, they would mark experience. And so you had this feedback loop.
Yeah, we saw this when Chuck ran it, when one person took gullible and one person took liar.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
The other thing about First Quest, which is also relevant to Sailor Moon, is the idea that the evil, the villain, whatever, has a personal, emotional connection to the hero. Even if it's just the issues. I mean, for example, there's one where the issue, that whole season of Sailor Moon is growing up, something Chibiusa is very torn on.
And I think one thing we've been trying to work into the system, I don't think we're done yet, is putting issues that the players care about, as well as the characters care about on the table, and having them be central to the campaign. The other thing there is that you've got a mechanic in, you've got a concept in Sailor Moon, and really pretty much every other show we've talked about, but it's most obvious, the bones are more visible in Sailor Moon, where you have a character who is, how should I put it, where you have an issue that shows up in the character's mundane lives, and it's important there, and then it becomes also central in some way to whatever fighting that's happening. Mm-hmm. So it's not that the fighting is coming out of nowhere, the fighting is in fact coming out of something they care about.
Yeah. Yeah, because there's always a question of, like, how do you design the monsters of the week or whatever you have? How do you, what kind of challenges you come up with, which is no small challenge for the GM. And having that kind of issue be the root of that larger challenge, so when you get to attack head-on at the end, but maybe still have to deal with personally, yeah, that can be very, very useful, just from GM's perspective as well.
So do you do, when you're setting all this up, do you have the players kind of create those bonds and things first and sort of try to mine a conflict from that?
Yeah, that's where we have character creation. It's just like when you set up notes between different skins, and monster hearts. You set different bonds and notes between characters as part of character creation.
Right. I'm just thinking, like, the overarching story, how Josh was mentioning making it personal to these characters' stories.
And that is something I really want to have there. When I have been present while James has been running, because I haven't run this yet, I'm sort of nervous about my running the game because I haven't run it before. And so I wanted to, you know, James ran our first playtest, and therefore he ended up being the GM at conventions. Also, he's done a lot more GMing than I have. Overall, I sort of tend to be an inconsistent GM. One of the things I like about the Apocalypse Engine is that it allows inconsistent GMs to have a guideline or something, sort of a structure to fall onto, and is therefore in many ways easier to GM correctly, but is trying to push people into putting issues on the table, saying what issues do you want to be important, and then having that be feedback into what do the monsters care about, what do the PCs care about, how are threats being generated, both in terms of mundane threats, but also magical threats.
I remember that being an interesting debate our group was having, what was important to us kind of as a team and individually.
Yeah, one last thing about having explicit concerns is that you can invent a particular challenge to that concern out of whole cloth if need be. Like if you see, for example, that someone's like worried about someone else going out at night late, or someone else's drinking problem, you can then make that more manifest issue a larger issue in the story for that, say, that session.
I like that a lot.
But you also have to walk that interesting line between modeling the source material and keeping it feral, because otherwise you might as well just sit down and watch Sailor Moon again.
Right. It's why you want to be able to have the mechanics put things in on the table, and you want to ask us about interaction mechanics, because that's someplace we've also gotten a lot of really good feedback that we need to figure out how to take into account. But you want to have the what actually happens be under the controls of the players in the game rather than something that is predetermined.
Yeah, because People Against Your Hearts is unusual in the, I guess, Apocalypse World in that it's much more, it's cooperative between players, at least assumes that, than a lot of other games might. I know Monster Hearts, for example, is very much built on the assumption that these are all petty, immature teens who have no idea how to deal with other people. And it makes a bunch of drama that Sailor Moon or the Magic Girls usually much more external. So something both to consider modeling, but at the same time, we might not model to the same degree of closeness just because it's a role-playing game with character interactions and not a TV show where we get to bring it all out from the outside.
So that's one thing that I find really interesting, hearing Avery talk about Monster Hearts and sort of the contrast between that and what we're doing with Beautiful Senshi Hearts, is that they're both really games about the preteen and teen experience. But Monster Hearts is about the experience of a teen where everything is changing around you. Your body is changing. You're changing. Your friends are changing. And so you're isolated. And you may have to reach out. You may be able to eventually grow up to the point where you're making more adult decisions and acting more like an adult, at least in some fashion. That's what all the adult moves are for. But your default experience is very much a matter of, no matter how many friends you have, no matter how many people that you have connections to, you're an island and no one's going to help you. You're going to have to grow up on your own, and maybe they'll be there for you in the end. Or maybe, you're going to have to push past them to do it. Whereas in Beautiful Senshi Hearts, we're trying to create an experience where, yes, the world is around you, things are changing, you're changing possibly in ways you don't control. But the way you're going to deal with this is not becoming an island. The way you're going to deal with this is finding friends who you can trust and who you can cleave to. And you're going to be forming your own nakama against the world.
Nice. And so that kind of explains this extra level. Instead of just strings, you have even stronger bonds with these teammates and the people around you. And that's part of what I imagine helps that narrative, makes you less of an island, makes you more of a team.
That's the idea, yeah.
Ooh, actually, as we're talking about that, I'm just wondering if we want to think about team moves.
Yeah, so how does that work out in the moves and the other options these characters have?
No, right now, yeah, we've got the Nexus has her special attack move, the finishing move that depends on notes and bonds or concerns as it however works out to power her up, and similar things between other characters. I'm just wondering, throwing out the idea right now of moves available to the team as a whole that might depend on certain circumstances, so on and so forth. Something to just throw out there, discuss maybe after the show.
Yeah.
But I guess, like, for the existing characters and moves, we've got you know, Nexus's move. We've got other ones that burn through notes to do certain things. Leverage bonds to get extra strength.
So all of the archetypes have some level of like teamwork-related moves?
Yep.
Or is it... Okay, cool.
So it's more than just teamwork, but also this, in order to show character progression, moves that will specifically put you in a situation that will make you reliant on others.
Oh.
Like in the case of the genius, the blue one, he has a particular move which is about her going ahead a little bit too quickly, almost breaking her tactician nature in order to get the knowledge that might actually put her in a situation where she relies on other people to save her. Like, let's say she goes on something like a spy mission in order to gain some basic research of where they have suspicious energies or some sort of reading on her device. So she goes ahead, forges ahead, thinking she's doing a reconnaissance mission, and she fails. Like, she just messes up her role in a specific way. And as a result, she ends up crying out to others. Or like as seen in Kyubey with his telekinetic abilities, help, save me. Totally make a pact with me in order to save me. Is that useful for you?
Oh, and in fact, the Nexus has a similar move, but flavored very differently. Because, of course, the Nexus is not an investigative character like the blue one, like the genius.
Hey, more Scooby-less Daphne.
So the Nexus's move is not based on being able to figure things out. It's based on being vulnerable. And so when they do the move where they find the trouble, they just step into the trouble. They're not looking for it necessarily. They're just unlucky or clumsy.
Literally stumble into it.
And so there is no fail. When you fail, you might end up in trouble. You're going to end up in trouble.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's actually part of the move. Like, you get in trouble, and what else happens?
Cute. I meant to ask, when we were talking about the archetypes, someone mentioned that the Inferno gets picked a lot and so on and like that.
That's usually more a factor of just not that many archetypes.
Yeah, there's not that many. And just like Monster Hearts, of course, people can pick whichever ones they want to be. Can you successfully play this without the Nexus?
Sure.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Interesting.
The Nexus is just another character, and she is unique in a specific way.
Mm-hmm.
While I can't particularly think of one off the top of my head, I know I have seen Magical Girl shows that do not have this necessary unifying factor. They just have all sorts of people who end up teaming up in a very particular way, and it ends up working.
What about the one with the giant robots? Magic Knight.
Magic Knight, Ray Earth.
Oh, Ray Earth.
Yeah, Ray Earth. Yes, you could. There are characters you could shoehorn into the Nexus role, but but really, that's not what it's about. There is no character who draws everybody together, but they're drawn together by the fact that they're put into a strange world.
Right, yeah. I would call the main character the Inferno.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To the degree definitely. It's the MacGuffin, the princess. She's not a character, really.
Yeah, she's an NPC.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, so she's not really...
She's not NPC.
Yeah, if you want to make a group that's especially dysfunctional and isn't that good at healing relationship damage, you can always elect to avoid the Nexus and get all the more inter-character conflict.
Yeah. In the same way, in fact, that you can do without the genius, because, you know, other people, one, people can take moves from other skins.
Yeah.
But also because, there are other people who have moves that will find them in trouble. They're moves that act very differently than the genius's moves to find out what's going on.
And particularly I think we have somewhat established there is some level of overlap with all of the skins, because everyone will on some level do similar things, just with a very different way of doing that. And as a result, different reactions and different results due to the same action. And so as a result, particularly like no other book has something like the finishing move that would have to be taken. That being said, the one reason you have the finishing move on the Nexus is because she's really bad at fighting. The rest of the characters have usually a better position when it comes to fighting, and as a result may not be reliant on it.
Exactly.
Actually, yes, about finishing moves and fighting and things like that. Monster Hearts isn't really built as a combat system. Mm-hmm. So how do you guys address that?
I think that's a work in progress. But
okay. That's fair.
So what we currently have is a combination of vague hit points like Monster Hearts has, and also specific outcomes that will put you in trouble. Mm-hmm. One of the things I'm very tempted to do at the moment is if you look at a game at like any anime with fighting, and certainly if you look at magical girl shows and certainly Sailor Moon, you don't really see people being whittled down over time. What you generally see is they're in a bunch of different states in combat. They are in a state where they're fine, where nothing seems to hurt them. You know, they're perfectly reasonable. You see in states where they're in trouble in some fashion. They're in jeopardy. They're vulnerable. You know, if it's a monster, the monster is open and is actually, the monster will spend a bunch of the time being invulnerable to attack at some point, assuming it's not some kind of mook. But, you know, but if it's, you know, a real threat, you're going to spend a bunch of time where anything you do to it, it's not going to work. And at some point, someone's going to open it up and now it's vulnerable. And the same way PCs, you know, they're either fine or they're vulnerable or they're, you know, wounded or dead or dying. And so I think having that be our combat system and focusing around that might be useful, where instead of having characters have wounds that, you know, where you can take a certain number of wounds, if you're vulnerable, someone needs to get you out, whether you or somebody else. And if not, then something very bad could happen to you.
So like basically a really condensed damage track or health track.
Mm-hmm.
Metaphorically, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I think Monster Hearts even condenses Apocalypse World down a little further, too.
And Apocalypse World itself, most of the Apocalypse Engine games kind of dance around the crunchy bits of combat and just go to the, okay, what do we really want to know?
Yeah, the exception, I think, is Dungeon World.
Well, yeah.
Where Dungeon World, you actually have, like, actual weapon damage and actual hit points.
Dungeon World aside, it is kind of perfect for magical girls in that it doesn't get crunchy.
Mm-hmm. I remember the very first game, I think it was, we spent entirely too much time fighting, when in subsequent playtests, the much more interesting part of the game was usually the after the fight and
yes.
Before the next fight. So I am entirely down with deeply compressing magic fights, especially if you can find some way of building up to flavorful but short fights.
Yes, absolutely.
That being said, we also have to figure out a system for making ridiculous names for moves, because that is mandatory.
We need a table. We need tables.
Please.
Yeah. So this is this actually ties into the question of experience track. Lisa mentioned earlier that Monster Hearts and, frankly, all Apocalypse Engine games tend to progress extremely quickly. And so we have this question of, if we want to have a slightly longer game, how do we have people get feedback from the system with experience quickly, mm-hmm. while still not having the game rush to a conclusion in three sessions if people want a longer game, longer play. So one of the things we've talked about is having flavor advances, where flavor advance is, you know, you pick up a cool move, your powers advance, your costume changes, something that shows your character is changing and growing in power without necessarily tying it to a mechanical change.
Yeah.
And putting those on the experience track gives people options for having their character clearly gain experience and become more powerful without becoming more effective.
My Aqualution is now green.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Now I'm just thinking I would really love to hear the kind of costumes that people come up with for their magical girl teams.
Yeah.
We have put together a small amount of this guidance for that, as I mentioned previously, with color. There are also mm-hmm. other details such as costume design. One thing that I think we should get around to putting in is everyday design, because that's not always the same.
Oh,
and
yes.
And it's pretty different.
You spend a lot more time out of costume than in it.
Yeah. And other details include your weapon. For example, I currently have, I'm opening up a random playbook book. I happen to like the genius, so let's go with that one. The weapon is divided into two different sections. One is the weapon itself. So options we currently have down are rifle, calligraphy, brush or pen, coins, visor, computer. And with that, we also have an overarching theme in order to unify the costume, the character, and how their magic comes into being. So the themes that we have currently down are knowledge, logic, mind, paper, writing, and water. So while I think we do need to polish it up more, in order to make it a bit more explicit, I think you can see there's already quite a bit of guidance for how intricate the costumes can get for these characters.
Yep. We do have a bit of a push and pull there,
which we need to sort of figure out in one fashion or another. Because, of course, the one of the pieces of, let's call it gaming technology, that Apocalypse Engine games use is that your character consists of a single booklet with four pages. And so that's a very constrained space. And if we're going to stick to that, there's only so much space we can give for flavor. But flavor is so important to these characters that, you know, we almost want to give more than that.
I think Urban Shadow does that quite well, because what they do is, one of the things I'm really sad they took out of the final version, but they actually did have a section referring specifically to hands.
Ooh.
But when you're designing your character, you go through and they put it in much smaller text so that they cram a lot more in. But it does set up a very well-flavored character before you start.
The tricky thing is you want to encourage creativity without limiting options, but you want to put something down so people aren't staring into a void. And you don't want to prescribe, but without a certain amount of mechanical benefit, there's only so much chrome I want to waste my time doing when I'm playing, because much though I say I want immersion, yeah, but what does this get me?
Yeah, I think when I played, there were blanks after some of the options as well. Like, the lists were provided with some suggestions, but we were also encouraged to, if we had another idea, to kind of go with that.
Oh, exactly.
Sure. It's one of the things that I love about Fate Core, as opposed to earlier versions of Fate, is that, you know, you only have to start with three aspects. And, you know, or maybe even fewer aspects, if you're only coming up with, like, you know, you really, really need your central aspect, and then you can come up with the rest and play, so that, you know, if you know what you're doing from the beginning, you can start out with a whole bunch of stuff written down. If you're not sure, you start out with what you need, and then you build it up as things come up based on what's happening in the game.
Oh, nice. Awesome. The other kind of corollary I wanted to know how you tackled is Monster Hearts. These characters get intimate with each other. It's not just about friendships or teamworks or bonds. There are sex moves, and it's encouraged that you get romantic to some degree. So does that come up at all in Sentry Hearts?
It is. We don't have necessarily a sex move as is in Monster Hearts, because that's a little bit out of theme. Like, you can have sex, that is totally a thing you can do, but what's more important is the relationship, so it's called a romantic move.
Ooh.
And so, again, I have the Genius open currently. It's one of those things where it realizes that romantic relationships can come to an end. So a lot of them, not this one specifically, but some of them have a detriment when the relationship comes to an end.
Yeah, like the Inferno, it just, like, burns through relationships.
Mm. Oh, yeah. No, the Inferno completely destroys relationships quickly. But dealing with the Genius's romantic move, and granted this might change in time, it refers to when you fall in love, you want to know everything about them. Gain four notes on secrets about the objects of your affection. At least two of these must be negative. They gain two notes about you based on secrets you've shared with them. And in that way, it continues to progress the story in a specific way and develop the relationships. Particularly, as I mentioned, two of those notes have to be negative, maybe even more. So you might find out things about your relation that you don't want to know.
Ooh.
We haven't talked about it, but if I were to try to translate that to a concern mechanic, I might have that, you know, when the Genius falls in love, they possibly even get an extra concern about their beloved, but it has to be something they don't like about them.
Cool. So is it encouraged that the players pursue these relationships with other player characters, or more so NPCs, or just sort of whatever happens?
Whatever happens.
Yeah,
Keep it, Pearl.
Yeah. I love it. I want to see this team play out.
That's one of the things we've been hearing a lot, which is, I expect you to have a playable version by X so I can play it.
Yeah, I think we clearly have not had problems finding people who were enthusiastic about the idea of the game. That was not an issue. And I think that there are a lot of Magical Girl games in the pipeline. I know there's at least one Magical Girl game that I have demonstrably and deliberately not looked at that has been released, that you're using the Apocalypse Engine.
Oh, okay. I think I know the one you mean, yeah.
But I think they're, based on what I've seen of it, I think they're very much trying to do only the Puella Magica thing. So I think they're taking very much a different line of things. But I want to make sure our game is formed enough that I don't feel like I am unduly influenced by them or anything, you know. But I think this, you know, and also with, you know, it's not like people have stopped making Magical Girl shows.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Their shows are still absolutely coming out. I've seen some of the Pretty Cure episodes are getting translated into English now. We've got Magical Girl webcomics, Magical Girl comics, Zodiac Star Force, and the like are in actual comic book shops where nerds go. So it is not a dying genre at all.
Even Netflix has their own Netflix-specific Magical Girl shows.
Yes. Yeah,
it's great.
Very much looking forward to this.
Is Glitter Force any good? I don't know. I haven't seen it.
Glitter Force is a dubbed season of the Pretty Cure Magical Girl show.
It makes sense why it's poorly rated now. Why wouldn't you dub a thing?
On the one hand, like, if Sailor Moon had never been dubbed, I never would have gotten into all of this. But on the other hand, we have so much more access to television than we did when I was watching Sailor Moon that I don't know if it needs to be dubbed as much as it was. I don't know. I watched an episode just to kind of see how it went, but that's also a season of Pretty Cure I never watched, so I couldn't tell you if it's that different.
Yeah, it's easy to forget that there's nothing wrong with dubs per se. It's just that a lot of dubs are just bad.
As long as it's not, you know, the dubs that we got in the 80s, where they completely changed the meaning of the show.
Yeah.
Yes, I don't think that happens from what I understand. I think there's a lot of localization that goes into it, so that's ruffling some feathers, but what do you expect? I mean, it is aimed for young English-speaking children, so that's cool. It's got its place.
I just think my biggest issue with dubs is just how they get so horribly translated frequently that it's more than the meaning changing, but even the small subtleties of relationships between characters, cousins, which usually mean a lot. And like, I'm thinking particularly in Inuyasha, you have Miroku commonly referred to as Hosama, or literally honorable monk,
right,
by the people constantly. But yet even in the subtitling, that frequently is completely cut out because it's not done in language, and it's kind of disappointing when in subtitles it's very easy to refer to someone as monk sir, which would carry most of the meaning, and yet we still go to Miroku-san.
Oh, and also if you're watching subtitles, you know, if you have enough of your ear to at least pick up the basics of Japanese honorifics, then at least you can pick it up from the audio.
And I'll be clear, I am not fluent in Japanese at all. I've just picked up some cultural commentary just because of a mixture of anime and a couple of Japanese classes that I've taken.
Well, I'm glad to report that Beautiful Senshi Hearts, there are no plans to dub Beautiful Senshi Hearts.
Good to know. Thank you.
One of the things we're trying to stay very conscious of is that we are doing a game using that is inspired by Japanese media for a Western audience. So there is definitely a risk of the bad kind of appropriation. I mean, it's an appropriative form, because frankly, all art that it takes from outside is appropriative. Frankly, all art is appropriative, but that's beside the point. But you want to be very conscious of the fact that, you know, it's very easy to get Japan wrong because most of us aren't Japanese. Now, one of the nice things is that this is a medium where they're frequently being appropriative too. They're frequently setting their stuff outside Japan in one fashion or another, even if you look at it and go, wow, these people who are outside Japan really are acting very Japanese. And so there's a lot of license to go, well, we're going to do a bunch of stuff with the themes from here, but we're not going to set it in Japan unless we're comfortable in Japan.
And tell it to the players as well to see how far they want to go with those different directions.
Yeah. So what else should our listeners know about Beautiful Senshi Hearts?
There's a website. It's going to be www.bsh.moe, M-O-E. So think Beautiful Senshi Hearts .moe. And that is moe like anime. That's actually what the top level domain means. And you can go.
Perfect.
Listeners want to go there, they can sign up to the mailing list. Know as soon as the book is out, there's a Kickstarter beforehand, progress updates, so on and so forth. So that'd be www.bsh.moe.
Awesome. We will definitely have that in the show notes so people can sign up to the newsletter or the mailing list, I guess. There'll be news on progress updates on when it's being released. Are you going to share playtesting information over the mailing list as well? Or
yeah, that's the plan. Wouldn't be like a mailing group, just a mailing list. So one way, but yeah.
Okay, awesome. Do you know offhand if you're going to be playtesting at any upcoming conventions?
Not off the top of my head. I know there is, assuming this gets out in time, DexCon in New Jersey at the very end of June, at July 4th weekend. So possibly then, we'll see. But again, that's what the mailing list will say.
So we had a fairly aggressive playtesting schedule, and then we had a bunch of changes we wanted to make, and not a lot of time to make them in. And so we sort of wanted to backed off a little bit, but we planned to, you know, among other things, I had to move. I think James had to move. Yes. That's apparently, moving is the thing people have to do, and it takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
I had a senior thesis, so that's also fun.
Well, you won.
And it turns out when you have a whole bunch of notes about things you want to change, and no one with any time to change them, they don't get changed. There's no magical change fairy. So
if only, that should be an archetype.
Yeah.
It's probably a brain's Chrome. Anyway.
Nice.
So, you know, we want to make sure that more playtesting, we want playtesting a version of the game that's useful rather than a version of the game we plan to change, where we know what we're going to change. So the hope is to be able to, you know, the next time we do playtesting, which should be soon, we're playtesting the new changes rather than the old version we've already gotten a lot of feedback on.
And if anybody is interested in playtesting, sign up for our mail or email, and that will allow us to communicate with people when we are ready for playtesting, which now that people have finally gotten a bit settled should start happening in the next few months, I believe. Not particularly until summer, but once summer starts, it probably is a safe assumption that we'll be in a position to playtest again.
Absolutely.
Now they know where to find more information on Beautiful Senshi Hearts. Where can folks find each of you online if you want to be found?
Yeah, I'm available at www.jcholder.com. That's the go-to URL for me. Mm-hmm.
I am currently a bit difficult to find online because I just don't have as much experience as my peers. So probably the easiest place I can be found is on Google Plus under the name Ann Ratchet.
Probably I am extremely Googleable because I've been on the net since the early 90s and haven't tried to hide my identity anyway. That said, probably my primary, I mean, labcats.org doesn't get updated a lot, but it is where I will tend to put projects as my domain. labcats.org.
Just picture two kitty cats wearing lab.
Yes, in fact, it's our domain. At least it's my domain. My primary gets updated a lot more often enough. Home on the internet tends to be my live journal, which is neme munu epsilon mu epsilon, only with English letters, .livejournal.com. Or
you're going to email me that link.
Remind me, and I will email to you. Actually, I'll probably just email you the Dreamhost because, you know, Okay. People don't use LiveJournal anymore. They use Dreamhost and they just pretend they're using LiveJournal.
I used to use LiveJournal.
I still do, but when I post Dreamhost.
I'm glad to know it's still around and still active. It was a good place.
And then there was Google Plus, but you know.
Yes, that'll never stop being funny. And the most important question is, which magical girl are you?
Oh, jeez.
Well, we already determined in the chat that I'm Sailor Moon.
Yes, because you are in a Sailor Moon LARP.
I played in a Sailor Moon LARP as Sailor Moon.
Not to mention, like, this entire group has been, hey, do you want to work on this game with me? Sure!
Yes, I believe my role in this group was also Sailor Moon.
Have the Nakama?
Okay, so I'm going to spin it around, actually. I'm going to spin around and ask, who do you think I would be at the original Sailor Moon cast? Doesn't have to be just the inner ones. You can go outer planets as well.
Ooh.
Is he the wise one?
I don't think it's worth that much credit.
You think it's the wise one, not the not the green one?
He could be the green one.
Yeah.
Nice.
I'll
take the wise one.
Yeah.
And who are you?
I'm the genius.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What?
Which one am I?
Lisa, you can also be the genius if you want. It's okay.
What am I? Or am I the kitty cat?
Oh, you're the wise one.
I'm the wise one. I thought James was the wise one.
Yeah, but you're the wise one.
We have two. We have Athena and we have an Artemis.
There you go.
It's true.
Oh, well, thank you guys so much. Well,
thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. Thanks again to everyone, Anne, Josh, James, and Lisa, for being on the show. It was a really great time, and I hope you'll check out their links in the show notes, as Beautiful Senshi Hearts is now several months further along than when we recorded this show. We are 2 weeks away from DexCon, and while it looks like Beautiful Senshi Hearts won't make an official playtest appearance, you may still be able to talk to Josh or JC about it if you're going. Last, but definitely not least, there's another thing I've been hoping to share with you all since Metatopia. If you like Modifier but want your game hacking a little more actionable, go check out a new show by my friends, or hashtag podcast rivals, Brandon and James, called Stop, Hack, and Roll. They come out every other Tuesday, the same weeks as me, in what we are apparently calling Hack Week. They're really good and fun, so give it a try.
That's it for this week, heroes. You can find Modifier on Twitter at Modifier Podcast or at the headquarters at modifierpodcast.tumblr.com. You can send comments, questions, or contribution suggestions to modifierpodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, please consider leaving a review on iTunes, as that helps more people find us. Modifier is a proud member of the One Shot Podcast Network, an amazing family of RPG podcasts that includes incredible shows like One Shot, Campaign, Backstory, and Talking Tabletop. Modifier's theme music was created by my favorite Bothan, Kat Greenfield, whose myriad talents are on display at katgreenfield.com. Next time on Modifier, I talk to Ro about Gamers Plane and Play-by-Post RPGs. See you then!